Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk and to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday on Mind Talk. Thursdays are the days that we talk to experts, and today's guest, I think, is going to quickly become the favorite expert for many. I am very happy to welcome to Mind Talk Dr. Stan Tatkin, who is the author of Wired for Dating. Dr. Tatkin, welcome to Mind Talk.
Hi, Pamela. Thank you so much.
Now, you have written a book that, does this book stay on the shelves by any chance?
I don't know. I'm not sitting at the bookstore that often.
Well, it's probably flying off the shelves because you've written something. You've written a book about something that pretty much everybody who can think is interested in. The name of your book is Wired for Dating: How Understanding Neurobiology and Attachment Style Can Help You Find Your Ideal Mate. Now, the first part of the title, Wired for Dating, that's going to make it fly off the shelves because everybody wants to know how to do that well.
Right.
The second part of the title is going to have some folks shaking their heads. So let's start with what you mean when you say how understanding neurobiology and attachment style can help you find your ideal mate. What are you talking about?
Understanding the nature of the human animal, understanding how the brain works, understanding how we as human beings need to pair bond and how we actually do it on a psychological level, on a biological level, and what are we wired for in terms of pair bonding? There's a lot of misinformation out there in terms of dating, finding the ideal mate, and one of the things that I've been concerned about through my whole career is prevention. Since I'm a couple expert, so to speak, I'm concerned about the way people get together and also how they stay together. And I think there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of misunderstanding about that. So we're looking here at it from a science and research point of view, hopefully to educate people so they can understand themselves a little bit better and understand what they're looking for and how to get it.
Now, when you say science, for a lot of folks, dating is you either feel it or you don't. You either like the person or, you know, it's just not a match. But it sounds like you're saying there's a more thoughtful way to think about it.
Well, there is a process by which we select somebody, and it's not by accident. So there are ways that we select somebody, and it may be that person will be in our lives temporarily. Maybe it's a one-night stand. That's quite different than the person that we decide to stay with or the person that we begin to find permanent in our lives. We pair bond by recognition. We don't pair bond with strangers. The person that you end up living with or that you want to spend more time with or you want to marry is likely someone that you recognize, someone who is familiar to you, even familial. If that person was too strangerish, you would walk away. So that speaks to the idea that we actually do, at least on a psychobiological level, pick correctly. But also in the beginning of a relationship, our brains are doused with certain neurochemicals that get us to stay interested in each other, and our judgment is a little bit off. And that person may be right for us, may not be right for us, and that is where we're interested in making sure that people are choosing the right person after that initial sort of being on, over the moon begins to wear off.
Now, when you say that people tend to, when they make the long-term decision, they tend to make it with someone with whom they recognize, you're not talking about they recognize them physically because they saw them 3 years ago.
No, but there are some interesting stats on physical recognition, like how large the side of the bridge of the nose is. There's some studies on that in terms of physicality. But no, I'm talking more in terms of recognition, how the person moves, talks, There's something about them that reminds us of others. We, you know, everything we do is by memory. So when we pick friends, it's by memory. When we see somebody that we don't like, it's usually by memory, especially, you know, at first glance. So, you know, our brain has a way of basically feeling, as you put it, whether this person is a familiar or familial to us, and then we're interested. They have to have a certain amount of strangeness, otherwise they wouldn't be novel and they wouldn't be interesting. But they also have to be familiar enough, otherwise we're too far away from home. And there's a recognition pattern that is mostly subcortical that is operating all the time.
So this familiarity, conscious, unconscious?
It is unconscious, but people often, you know, when they fall in love, they feel, oh, I've known you. It feels like I've known you forever. It feels like, you know, we've known each other. That is, again, an aspect of memory that is placing that person in some familiar way, either a part of ourselves along with parts of others that we've met. This is how we instantly like someone or instantly don't like somebody. This is a process of deep memory, what we call procedural memory. And no, it's not conscious in the sense that, oh, I'm going to look around and see who I, you know, who reminds me of somebody. It happens automatically. And then lo and behold, we start to like somebody until there's something that strikes us as off. And if that happens too often, then we walk away. And that's where we get into attachment.
Now, you say that you've described your book as having been written primarily with the goal of helping the reader to find a single long-term monogamous partner, which struck me in this day when all kinds of partnerships are being formed and celebrated. So you're kind of sounding a little bit old school.
Well, actually, not monogamous. We do live in a time that a lot of other practices are coming to the fore. They've been there all along, but you know, people are much more open about their sexuality, about their gender identification, and about their sexual preferences. So you can be polyamorous and still follow the guidelines of the book. This is not about commitment. It's not about, you know, traditional relationships or traditional marriage. It's simply about something we call secure functioning. Is the relationship, whatever that relationship is it set up to last? Is it a really a two-person psychological system, or three or four, depending on what you're involved in? And is it based on fairness, justice, and sensitivity? Is it collaborative? Is it truly mutual? That's what we focus on. It's not the person. It's not the agreements that you make. Except we do expect that the couple or the person who's seeking out a relationship, according to our book, that they think about the kind of a relationship they want. Not so much the person, but what should this relationship be? What should the function be? You know, do we have each other's backs? Are we in the foxhole together? Are we experts on each other? What do we agree on? What don't we agree on? And that's, I think, the most important thing here is, you know, what are you looking for? Why do you want to be in a relationship? What are you going to do for each other you couldn't pay somebody else to do? What's going to be the function of the relationship? And from my point of view, the most fundamental part of that is survival, you know, being in each other's care. That's the primary message of the book. And that's not what people are doing. That's not how they're planning. That's not what they're looking or thinking about when they look for a mate or a partner or a best friend.
It's very true. Now, on the one hand, though, you're saying that survival is something that is important and really sustaining. It can be. On the other hand, you've said, though, that we are more naturally wired for war than for love. So now I'm getting confused.
Well, we are wired for both. We have a basic human need for love. That's just something we have to do. But our brain is tilted towards war. And what that means is the human brain has what's called a negativity bias. all things being equal, the brain tends to go negative. And one of the reasons we have so many areas of the brain specialized in keeping us alive is because we're good at detecting threat. And it's very easy to feel threatened even by somebody that we love. And I mean threat, I mean small t threat, not big t threat. It's not being beaten or threatened with your life, but the tilt of the head, the raising of the chin, the tone of the voice, gestures, rolling of the eyes, things that happen on a day-to-day basis that begin to feel threatening to partners. And this is very, very easy to do if people don't understand what that process is. So love can, you know, can be overtaken quite easily by an increasing or an accruing sense of threat that's going back and forth between partners. These are basically misattuned moments that keep repeating, and they amplify. People get overly aroused, dysregulated, and they start to feel threatened by each other. This is a biological process. And that's just our tendency. That's why we go to war so easily as a species. And there's lots of reasons why this happens if we're not aware. For one thing, human communication, even on a good day, is really terrible. We take that for granted. We think that people are understanding us when they're not. We think we're being understood when we're not. And because the brain is built on a process of automation, in other words, we want to learn anything novel and new in such a way that it can be automated, so our brain is freed up to do more new things. So this process of automation includes shortcuts that the brain takes. Now, that's good in life, because otherwise we couldn't accomplish things. We couldn't do more and more. But it's bad in relationships, because shortcuts, along with communication being terrible, creates a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of errors. And this is going by extremely fast. People don't really know they're doing them. They're making things up when they're in distress. And there you go. Now you start to have a process that's very warlike, usually based on misunderstandings, nothing more.
It's interesting because, you know, at some point, and I know that you know more than many, a couple, if they've been together for a while, many people will assume that, you know, they shouldn't have to finish a sentence because their partner should know what they mean. They shouldn't have to do a whole lot of things. It should all be natural and you shouldn't have to think about it. And it sounds like what you're saying is, no, you really do need to take care in a different way.
I think there is something to a natural flow between a couple where they finish each other's sentences. But part of that is allowed by both people's attitudes. In other words, those people who complete each other's sentences without complaint, they do so because they enjoy collaboration more than accuracy. We're never that accurate. Two brains are not. Memory is flawed. Perceptions are like a funhouse mirror. Almost everything that goes on between two people is fodder for fighting and misunderstanding. So the automation process, the shortcuts we take, can actually cause us a lot of trouble if we're not feeling good about each other, if we're not feeling collaborative. When we're feeling collaborative, we let a lot of things go. But that's when we're feeling good. If we're not feeling good, we become aware of how many errors we're making, but we think it's being done purposely by the other person. We track this, by the way, Pamela, by watching couples very carefully. We use something called digital frame analysis, where we're watching faces and voices and movements frame by frame, forwards and backwards, and we can see how quickly this kind of communication goes. When people misunderstand each other, which is much of the time, real time is too fast. We can't possibly know what we're doing or why in real time in interactions. So we mostly make things up if we get into a jam. And this is what we start to see with all human beings, not just this couple or that couple, all couples. It's fascinating, and people really don't understand that this is happening, and they're blaming themselves, they're blaming each other, they're falsely accusing the other when, again, they don't understand that they are not being careful enough, they're not thinking enough, they're not paying attention, they're not being present any longer, because the brain doesn't need to. I think I know you, right? And that becomes a dangerous thing, because now you become everything and everyone that has ever happened to me. That's how the mind works. And so you behave a certain way, and that reminds me of another experience I've had, and I think it's you. And now everything I see falls in line with that early experience. My perceptions change, my memory changes, everything. People need to know that this is happening so that they can take precautions, one of which is really learning to pay attention and slow things down and be present with each other.
Now, I mean, clearly it sounds like we, just as a species, have a lot of work to do.
Well, it's always been that way, and I don't think nature really cares. See, nature doesn't care about long-term relationships. It cares, that the species survives. There's propagation, replication, mixing up the gene pool. But this idea of long-term relationship and marriage as we think of it is a social construct. Nature has really no plan for that. That's something that we do. Otherwise, we'd be pair bonding for 4 years and then leave each other and mix up the gene pool, which is more natural for the human being.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You say that secure functioning, and you've said that since the beginning of our conversation today, that
right.
Secure functioning is a core for successful relationships, and that it consists of security, sensitivity, justice and fairness, collaboration, and true mutuality.
Yes.
So, I think about folks who have been told, either by themselves or others, who want this, who are looking for this, you're asking for too much. You're being too picky.
Yeah. Actually, what we're describing here is not too much. Most of what people are asking for, really, when you get down to it, are expecting too much, are asking too much. We're talking about being in the foxhole together, being, in a situation where you and I have each other's backs. We are two separate human beings, two separate brains with different wants and different, moods and tensions at any moment. So how do we do this together? Well, this is, you and I, if we got together, we'd be the smallest unit of a society. So we would have to accept our differences. We'd have to accept that we're burdens. All people are pain in the rears. There is nobody who isn't. And we accept that about each other. We accept our differences. And we decide we're going to do something. We're going to protect each other. We're going to know each other better than we know ourselves. We're going to provide a function to each other that nobody else wants except in childhood because we can. So basically, we're doing things for each other you couldn't pay somebody to do. Now, this is not a unicorn. We see people, cop car partners, they do it because they must. They have to protect each other from the environment they're in. They know things about each other that others don't. They are the first to know things. They're the go-to people. They protect each other in public and private. They, in fact, are a secure functioning couple to a degree that sometimes these relationships interfere with marriages. Navy SEALs people, they have to do it. That's part of the culture. You have to look out for your partner. Otherwise, you don't get in, no matter how strong you are. There are street people. I see them. I have some in my practice, and these people are homeless, and some of them are, are mentally ill, but they do it. So this is, I think, more of a natural thing than you might think. We live in a society, thank God, that we're not having to dodge bombs. But if we were, as so many people around the world are, we wouldn't have time to consider whether we're soulmates or not. We'd be too busy caring for each other and watching out for each other. We don't seem to get that here, that we have a biological need to protect each other from predators and from the environment, and that's a necessity, not a luxury. And then there's other things we do to help each other thrive. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. You talk about attachment styles.
Yeah.
I'd like for you to explain to the listeners what you mean by just attachment styles, and then we'll talk about the styles that you define.
So attachment refers to safety and security starting from birth. And that sense of safety and security we have in the world is actually provided by our relationship, our most important dependency relationships. That gives us a sense of unity, but also freedom to do things, explore the environment. It gives us courage. But in order to have that courage, we have to have a secure base. That person is mother, father, or some caregiver. That caregiver or caregivers have to be resourced and interested and curious enough to be available for this, and also have to have a culture or come from a culture where relationship comes first, and this is essential. So in the secure culture, relationships tend to come first before performance, before appearances, before having to be loyal or stay dependent. All of these things that are demands that parents or caregivers can make that zap resources from the child who needs those resources in order to develop and to venture out into the world. Then there are families who are not as secure, and where a child has to take care of a parent's self-esteem or perform and appear and do things in a certain way over relationship, or another child that is encouraged to stay dependent and take care of an ailing parent or a depressed parent or a parent who's preoccupied. That child is also insecure in the sense that it's a situation that is not fair or just or sensitive enough of the time. That person goes forward in life and creates the same relationships.
I'm sorry, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we are going to continue to hear more about and learn more from you about anchors, islands, and waves and attachment styles. We'll be right back, folks. Dr. Tatkin, in Wired for Dating, you talk about not only the different kinds of attachment styles, but you also make it very clear that the way in which children are exposed to their universe and the way in which their caregivers respond to them is hugely powerful in terms of that child's development. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, it's true. On the level of safety and security, we look at a system called signal response. As a baby, as a teenager, as an adult, I signal to you, either verbally or nonverbally, some way that I want you to come near, something that I need, something that I want, and you respond. Now, there's a time issue here, depending on how young I am and my perception. So the time it takes for you to respond to my signal is one factor. How you respond, whether it's attuned to what I was actually signaling for, is another factor. And one more is if I have to pay for having signaled in the first place, there are consequences, that's yet another factor. And this becomes the calculus by which I signal again in the future. So in attachment, we're only dealing, like I said, with safety and security. And this is how I move toward you and away from you, how long I can stay in contact, physically or emotionally in contact with you, and like a built-in timing mechanism I have to push away or get away. So the anchor, the secure, is someone who can really seek proximity very freely, stay in contact for a lengthy time without feeling engulfed or trapped or taken over or interfered with. And I don't feel overly worried or sensitive to withdrawal or abandonment, being left. And so I'm unencumbered by those fears that are sort of built into my memory system, and I freely move through relationships, with relationships, without that kind of stress, interpersonal stress. Now, the person who was neglected, who was performance-driven in the family, who was encouraged to never be needy and to be independent, it has an allergy to dependency and is very distancing, has a hard time with proximity seeking, has a hard time with maintaining contact. They need relationship like everyone else, but their fears come up around losing their independence, losing their things, losing their sense of self when they start to depend on another person. We call those islands. The other side of that spectrum we call waves. This is the person who is afraid of someone there, not there. They're there, affectionate, available, but then they are not there, not available, rejecting, withdrawing. These people are very sensitive to the threat of anybody leaving, withdrawing, rejecting, punishing them, and they go through their life when they become dependent on somebody, fearing this kind of thing. And so they behave in certain ways that pull the person close and then pushes them away. Now, these people can do just fine in secure functioning relationships, but they have to understand who they are, how they operate, and take responsibility for it. And if I pick you as an island, that's fine. I just have to know how you work and why you work the way you do, and accept you as you are. It's a matter of mastery, understanding you, not a matter of you not being fit for a relationship or me not being fit for a relationship. Does that make sense?
It does. But, you know, when you describe the three styles, anchor, island, and wave, I'm thinking that everybody wants to be an anchor and everybody wants to be in a relationship with an anchor. An island and wave, they can kind of go away on an island and wave all they like, because anchor is really what folks are going to want.
Well, that's the thing, though, is that you could be an anchor, and I, you know, let's say I'm more distancing, you become very wave-like. This is not as perfect as you might think, and it's not actually as rigid as one might think. These systems are quite fluid. You know, they change with relationship. Somebody who is very wave-like can become more secure in a relationship, but somebody who is very secure can also become insecure in a relationship and become more island or wave-like. So this is very fluid. It has to do with the quality of the primary attachment relationship that we're in, and that usually is a love relationship. And that begins to shape and reshape the way we feel about dependency.
So if I am, well, let me ask you this. You've said that these attachment styles can be fluid. So it is not true that once an anchor, always an anchor. I can move in and out.
That's right.
At the point that I am with someone and I'm listening to you and I've read your book and I've decided, okay, I'm an anchor, but that person is a wave. I just can't deal with it. Is that true?
If you were an anchor, you could deal with it, because we're talking about flexibility and being able to understand another person and knowing how they work. If anybody listening thinks that anchors are easy and everyone else is hard, then they don't understand the human being. All people are difficult. There's no such thing as a low maintenance person up close. Everyone's high maintenance. Everyone is annoying and irritating. That's just the way of life. Here we're talking about predicting how someone is going to behave, how they act, and why they do what they do when they become interdependent. Understanding is everything. We're hurt by people. We're healed by people. It's a chance to do better in relationship. So if you were an anchor, one would wonder why you couldn't manage someone who is a wave, because you should be able to understand them and work with them.
Just decided I don't want to be an anchor anymore.
There
are exercises that you offer in the book, and one of them is your dream partner. And the exercise is interesting, and, you know, a lot of people really get kind of caught up, I think, in just this exercise, just wanting what they want because that's what they want. Talk about that dream partner relationship exercise, if you would.
Well, first, let me just say about the dream partner. Dream partner is just that. It's a dream. It's in your head. That partner, until they exist, is not real. And so what are you really going to do? Are you looking for your dream partner or your dream relationship? If you're looking for your dream partner and not your dream relationship, you're in trouble already, because you get what you pay for. If all you're thinking about is a tall, handsome man or a beautiful woman, or this person makes this money or has this particular worldview, that's insufficient. We're talking about what should we be doing as partners? What shouldn't we be doing as partners? In other words, I want a partnership that includes two people. This is what we do. This is what we don't do. This would be basically the sort of the moral directives, the big ticket items in terms of our principles. Most people, when looking for love, they're not thinking about what the relationship should be. And so they throw any idea about relationship over for the infatuation or the wanting this person above all else, even though looking into the future even a little bit, they would see trouble. So we want people to focus squarely on the relationship. That person will come according to how you envision the relationship should be. And think not just of yourself, but the other person. This is good for me. This is good for this person. I want someone who wants to play in that sandbox that we're calling secure functioning. Truly mutual, truly collaborative.
Is there ever a time that it makes more sense to go than to stay?
Yeah. I think that when you are with somebody who does not believe in the things you believe in, like, for instance, let's say you believe that I want a relationship where we are transparent, where we're open books. I don't want to spend a lot of effort or resources hiding. I want to be myself. I want you to be yourself. So I'm done with secrets and hiding. That's what I want. But if I am with you and this is not something that I'm keeping an eye on, do you feel the same way I do, then I'm ignoring a potential deal breaker. If you are someone and you could have very good reason and it's fine, it's not such a good idea that we tell each other everything. I think we should have secrets. I think that's not a great idea. I have to decide whether that is the kind of principle I agree with, that I want to be in the foxhole with that person. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Or I want monogamy, and you could take it or leave it. That's an important thing to know, because that's going to be a deal breaker down the line if it's not settled now. So I think people shouldn't be with each other if that person does not agree with core principles, core principles that they can mutually agree on, that protects both partners from each other and from the outside world. We're talking about being an adult, really thinking, futurizing, talking about what's important and not, what's not important. People get into relationships and they think it's about physical attraction, always. The same, interests, always. That we're on the same page, always. Or that, that we're in love, whatever that means. These things are transient. What isn't transient are the agreements that people make to each other. Feelings, thoughts, emotions, all of that tilt and sway throughout the days and years. But people's agreements, what they believe in, are fairly steady. And that's what people don't seem to be doing enough, and then they get blindsided. Or they basically end up with what was actually a problem, but they kicked the can down the road, mm-hmm. and they decided they were going to defer this issue.
You know, I'm reminded of a couple that I who came in years ago, and one of them was they were engaged to be married, and in a relatively short period of time, and one was absolutely committed to monogamy, and the other one was absolutely committed to an open relationship. They both decided, because they were so good together with each other, that each one could change the other.
Oh boy!
Yeah.
As a couple therapist, I see this all the time. And people don't seem to understand that you don't go into these relationships to change somebody. You and I go into this to be ourselves. We accept each other as is, cherry-picking ends, auditioning ends. We decide, we go all in. I put all my money on you. You put all your money on me. That's how we do business. Other people want to bend reality, because if they looked at squarely, they might see that the relationship can't continue. So it's not uncommon for you and I to, let's say, you want children. That's something you've wanted your whole life. And I never wanted children. I hate children. And this is a very strong feeling that I have and that you have. We look at each other, we look over the precipice, we see the end of our relationship, and then we look at each other and we go, let's buy a house.
Right.
And that's what people do.
Exactly. And those are painful choices. Yeah. Ultimately.
Well, it's a painful choice, but what happens if they do this is actually far more painful and far more self-destructive.
The myths that people carry around in their heads, you go through several of them, but one of the very first ones you talk about that you say is a myth is that the theory that you have to love yourself before you can love someone else.
Yeah, that's really, boy, that's developmentally unsound. It doesn't make any sense. Imagine a baby coming out of the womb. Does it love itself before being loved? No. Does it actually do anything before it happens from the outside? No. It learns about itself through another. It learns how to love through another. It learns how to do almost everything through another person. This is the way it is. It will always be this way. And so this idea of self versus something that's interactive is a mistake. There is no self by itself. We are interactive animals. If you were raised by wolves, you wouldn't be burdened by many of the things that we are burdened by, such as shame or guilt. You might feel a little bit of it, but you wouldn't be burdened by it because you have no referent. These are all human constructs that are part of human interaction. I learned to love myself by loving you well. I learned to know myself by knowing you very well, and you do that with me. This is a dynamic process that is simultaneous. It's not done in a cave. It's not done in a book or a workshop. So it's folly to think that. It's impossible, and people are being misled.
You just used a phrase, loving you well. And
yes.
As we know, my idea of loving you well might be very different from your idea of being loved well or of loving me well. What do you do in those kinds of situations?
Secure functioning people, couples, are fully mutual, and they demand it, they expect it. It's not codependency. What I do for you, I expect in return. This is a mutual agreement for survival. This is what we do for each other. Therefore, I have to do what works for you, not for me. I love you in the way that works for you, not in the way that works for me, and you do the same. This idea of I give you things that I want and I'm disappointed because you're not happy is my problem because I'm not you. I have to learn you. What makes you happy? What makes you feel loved? What makes you calm down? What makes you feel better when you're in distress? This is what people have to do as two people with separate brains. This is a two-person system. Now, people who operate from a one-person system, which is basically an insecure culture, think in terms of what's good for me must be good for you. If it's not good for you, then sorry. I want you to do it the way I'm thinking about in my head, or I want you to be happy with what I do for myself. This is not fair or just or sensitive. I have to learn you. You're not me. You have to learn me. I'm not you. And this is what we have to do as a society, as a larger culture also. This is not just for the lovers. But again, the lovers are the smallest unit of a society. If you think about it, the rules by which a couple operates in terms of fairness, justice, and sensitivity spreads downward to the children and outward to the community. If the couple is operating improperly, not only will they be unhappy, but everyone around them actually doesn't function as well as a result. Does that make sense?
It does. The idea of being one unto yourself, which is very popular, I got to be me, I got to take care of me, I have to put me first, I can't rely on anybody but me. You say that's one of the myths, that you shouldn't rely on one person for your well-being.
Well, you shouldn't rely on one person for your well-being.
Different.
One person is not everyone. We have to have a huge social net. But we have a primary person. And, you know, those of us who don't have a primary don't want one. Usually there's some injury early in childhood that informs me that it's not safe to do that. But generally speaking, we travel not just in packs, but we form dyads within packs, twosomes. So we're very twosome-oriented. We need at least one person that we can tether to deal with the vicissitudes of life, the slings and arrows of life. This is true in infancy, in childhood. It's true in adulthood. Even though we are born alone, die alone, the journey we take must be with someone else. Otherwise, it's too stressful. It's too anxious, anxiety-provoking. Life is not that easy. So we need to pair up in a way that we can lean and trust and depend on each other. And again, that's through deeds and principles, not because it's easy and automatic and natural.
What about, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like for you to respond to the notion that many people have, which is, you know, I've been married for 50 years, my spouse is gone, you know, I'm just not going to deal with anybody else ever. I can't. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like for you to talk about that person and that belief system. All right, Dr. Tatkin, I have been married for 50 years. My spouse is gone. I'm just too old to start dating. Isn't that correct?
Really? I didn't know there was a cap on that. Why? I think maybe dating might be the problem here, the word. You still need relationship. What are you going to do?
Well, I'm going to grieve the loss of my spouse. But I'm too old to find somebody. I'm too old to find somebody. I don't know, 75, 80 years old. What am I doing looking for a partner?
Because we need it, you see. This is not an optional thing. I mean, it is optional. There are people, by the way, should be said, who are very happy not being in a committed relationship. This is not, you know, everyone should be in a committed relationship, and you're terrible if you're not. So having said that, we still will need relationship. Whether it's a best friend or some best friends. If something comes along that sparks our interest that is more romantic, wonderful. But to cut that off and to say, I don't want a relationship anymore, is an early grave, because we know, as interactive social beings that we are, if we don't have relationship with people, we become very ill, and this is not a natural state for us. So, yes, you may not want to go out and go to bars, you know, or go on the internet, or go on Tinder at 75 years old, but to not be open to relationship would be a troubling problem, one that hopefully family would intervene on, because it's not healthy.
Mm. All right. So those are just among some of the myths that you address in Wired for Dating. You also give some examples of how to argue with each other. As I was reading it, I thought, okay, so these are saints who are arguing with each other. You know, your suggestion is that they check in with each other while they're arguing. Help me out.
Remember I said that it's very easy for us to go to war. We are, in fact, animals, and we are automatic, And as I said, real time is too fast. We don't really know what we're doing most of the time. Human communication is incredibly flawed. Our memories are driven by our state. Our state changes the way we see, feel, and hear, and smell. Therefore, if we don't be careful, we can get into fights and arguments and get into big trouble everywhere if we don't understand how to do relationship. So this is not just about love. It's about understanding how to get what you want without burning bridges, without creating a big battle. In order to do that, I have to go into this knowing what you want, what you're afraid of. And I have to take care of myself at the same time, take care of you, otherwise I get nothing. Going back to your earlier mention, I wanted to say, you know, the person who says, I got to take care of myself now. I've got to look out for me. If I were in a relationship with you, if we were in a relationship, what does your gut say when I tell you that? I need to start taking care of myself, Pamela. I need to start looking out for me. Does that make you feel like you better start looking out for yourself now?
Yep.
Does that make you feel safe?
Nope.
No, because that stance by itself sets a tone that is adversarial. I may not mean to be doing that, but that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm setting up a situation that is threatening to you. And then I will complain when you react strangely because you are now threatened. The same thing in a fight. We get into distress. If we get too excited, we start to go into a very primitive warlike state where we are protecting ourselves. We shoot first, ask questions later, because the part of our brain that is active now wants to survive, and the part of our brain that is reasonable is offline because we don't have any resources for those high octane, very expensive parts of the brain to run. So it's in my best interest to make sure as I'm getting what I want with you or arguing with you, that I make sure that you are okay. Because if you are in that primitive state, it's game over. I get nothing. Nothing happens. We just spin out and hopefully live another day to repair this and go back and try again. So it is smart that I pay attention to you while we're fighting, that I make sure that you are not in fight or flight. Otherwise, I get nothing. And nothing happens. I have to make sure that I wave a flag of friendliness so that you don't mistake me for a predator, which is very easy to do if I am frustrating you quite a bit or if I'm doing things that make you feel like you are not safe or secure in the relationship. Now, if I don't pay attention to that, then it's going to be I'm going to pay the consequences, in other words. Okay. So I have to make sure that you're okay as I'm getting what I want. You have to make sure I'm okay as you're trying to get what you want. This is how we do business. And we're very careful to take care of each other while we're fighting. I know it seems like a difficult thing to do, but the consequences are far more difficult if you don't do it.
I got to tell you, I'm still thinking sainthood here.
It's actually smart. There's nothing saintly about this. If I throw my weight around and just complain or just do things and talk at you without paying attention to your state, without watching your face, then I am going to get blowback. Something's going to happen. No good deed goes unreturned. No bad deed goes unreturned. And you're going to retaliate. You're going to defend yourself. You're going to protect yourself. And if I continue to do that, you're going to know that I have no interest in your welfare, rightly so, and you're either going to fight or flee, or something will happen that's going to be destructive to the relationship. So this is not sainthood. This is perhaps political, it's perhaps good social grace and skill. Every negotiator knows exactly what I'm talking about. This is high-level social emotional complexity. It's simply understanding how people work. And since we're not children anymore, I know that I have to take care of you at the same time as I take care of myself, or deals off, nothing happens.
So it really is a a place of preservation, if you will, of self and other and the relationship.
Yes, absolutely. And the reason I keep saying in secure functioning relationships, one of the strongest things that are their tenets is that our relationship comes first. We believe in collaboration. We believe in win-win situations, not win-lose. Secure functioning folk know that in a win-lose situation, everyone loses, because there's no way I won't pay for that. If I win at your cost, I will pay for that.
Right.
It just doesn't make any sense. So, yeah, go ahead.
Talk about a couple pact. What is that?
Well, it is our couple bubble. It's our environment, our 10 commandments, or whatever we want to think of them. It's what we believe in deeply that serves a personal good and a mutual good. So, for instance, let's agree that we will never threaten the relationship. And the reason we will never threaten the relationship is because it's earth-shattering. And when we do that, and we're not serious about leaving, we create a massive insecurity that takes up tons of resources, and we can no longer do our day effectively. We're not as creative, we're not as focused, we're not as nice. And that's because, as human beings, we need to know that the relationship will exist tomorrow. It's not going away. We do that for each other because we can, and this releases resources for us to develop, to be creative, to do other things. We don't mess with that. And so we have, as a principle, we never threaten the relationship because it's mutually destructive. We are going to protect each other in public and private because that couple bubble, we are protecting each other from the environment, and we're jealously also protecting the resources that we create. We're going to, perhaps this is one of yours, maybe not, we're going to be fully transparent because we don't want to spend resources to lie or to hide. We're going to be ourselves. My wife and I have something. If either of us are in distress, we drop what we're doing and we minister to the other. That's something we do. It's not always convenient, but it works out. The quid pro quo is, even if I don't feel like it at that moment, I do it because she's going to do the same thing for me. And this is how this burden that is a relationship begins to work out in terms of fairness, right? We do things for each other that no one else wants to do because we decided to.
So again, the notion, the experience of being safe and secure is critical to the survival of a relationship.
Yeah, we know from watching infants, watching toddlers, watching children and adults that when the relationship is insecure, people are more accident prone. They have, by definition, attention deficit. And one of the first things that goes out is attention. They are not as happy. They're not as social. They're not as healthy physically and mentally. It takes up so many resources, this insecurity about the relationship. With babies, they don't even hold themselves up. They lose muscle tone. They flop around. They pick toothy animals because they're more angry as babies. As adults, the same thing happens. We're more prone to car accidents, breaking bones, all sorts of things. It's no small matter. And adults, people who are secure functioning folks, they get it. And they know not to mess with this stuff because it's self-harming to do it. So you and I have this couple bubble, an environment where we provide clean air, clean water for each other. This allows us to do things we ordinarily wouldn't be able to do in our lives. We know that if one of us messes up this environment, we both suffer. So we're good stewards of this safety and security system because it is at the ground level of our ability to thrive in life.
And I would think that being aware of what the attachment style is for yourself as well as your partner helps you to understand some of each other's security requirements.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I know you. I know what you do. You're predictable. I know what to do when this or that gets triggered. I know how to minister to you. I know exactly what buttons to push. I have a PhD in you. I am a Pamela whisperer. And I do that because it's important for me to do this. In order for us to be able to do things out in life, We have to be good caregivers of each other. Otherwise, everything else falls, everything else suffers.
At what point do you, once you've made the decision, for example, that this relationship is not working, that our core values are so different that we're just not going to reasonably come together, is there a way to leave the relationship safely depending on your style, your attachment style, or your partner's attachment style?
If people understand what we're trying to teach about how the brain works, how the human being works, people will begin to understand that most of the time people are not doing anything purposely to harm the other, that people are trying the best they can, that mistakes are being made on both sides, and it's basically no fault. Now, when you get into someone who's an island, they could easily be blamed for being so distancing and so disconnected and so rejecting and maybe even holding secrets that they would tank any relationship. But as an island, you hopefully know who you are and you take responsibility for what you do as an island because you want a secure functioning relationship. Now, if we decide that it's not working, the big question is why is it not working? Because there's so many reasons why relationships subjectively aren't working. But if it's something we talked about, a deal breaker, you want to do drugs, I don't want drugs in the house, and we would be unhappy if we bent on these ideas, these core values, then we would have to say, we love each other, but this is too big for us to continue together as partners. The island is obviously going to be easier in the first part of this because they're usually in denial of loss and they look like they'll feel good pretty well. I mean, they'll be okay. The wave is not going to look so good because of his or her sensitivity to withdrawal and abandonment. There might be some differences there in terms of how they experience a breakup. But generally speaking, when people are sober about this and they really understand the real reasons for breaking up, they're both on the same page. And though it's breaking up is always hard to do, it takes a long time to get over, they're generally able to do it amicably.
So it sounds like you're saying that an adult can really be thoughtful about a breakup if a breakup is to occur, and they don't have to lop each other's heads off the way so many couples try to do.
Well, again, it is natural for us to stick. We're very sticky in our relationships. Like the song, breaking up is very hard to do, and there's a part of us that can never really understand why love ends, why we're losing somebody. And we go through, people are familiar with Kubler-Ross's, stages, but we're basically going through a grieving process of anger and resentment and sadness and bargaining and depression and all that stuff, because it is not natural for us to easily break up. It just isn't. Anybody who does that and turns around and finds another relationship there's something else going on that enables them to do that. The natural state is to mourn. The natural state is to grieve. We invest so much of ourselves in a relationship that we lose more than the other person. We lose the part of ourselves that was alive in that relationship. There's a lot to mourn and a lot to grieve. Some people can do that without rancor. Other people find it very, very hard. Because that little child inside does not understand why love has ended. It's not supposed to happen.
Indeed. Dr. Stan Tatkin, author of Wired for Dating, How Understanding Neurobiology and Attachment Style Can Help You Find Your Ideal Mate. In fact, Dr. Tatkin is the author of several books. Is there a website that folks can go to learn more about you and what you're doing?
Yes, people can go to stantatkin.com, and there they'll find videos and writings and all sorts of resources. And the sister site, thepactinstitute.com, PACT is spelled P PACT, that's really for people who are, caregivers, therapists, who want training, who want to learn how we teach this to therapists. This is a psychobiological approach. And so people want information about that can go to thepactinstitute.com.
Terrific. Thank you very much for joining us today and sharing your wisdom with us today.
Thank you, Pamela.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk comes to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, you can send an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And again, that is mindtalk.org. And of course, remember that you can always go to mindtalk.org and listen to anything and everything you've heard on demand at your leisure. And folks, in closing, let me remind you, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.